And with that, we'll start off today with our first speaker on AA, a Society of Alcoholics and Actions, with Wayne.
Thank you, Julian. My name is Wayne Klein. I'm an alcoholic. Wow. I see you let your local nut ward join your meetings here, too. Actually, the truth is, those are some folks who had nothing better to do in South Dakota and Montana and various other planets and decided to come to Canada, seeking refuge, I guess. My sobriety date's November 16th of 1986, and I'm thankful for that. And that applause is obviously for Alcoholics Anonymous. I can assure you that it's Alcoholics Anonymous, and not near as much to do with me as it has to do with Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous and what they've passed on to me. God's grace working through this program. And this topic, I was reflecting, I guess, on the topic here over a period of time here recently, and I was reminded of in 1986, I was living in Bozeman, Montana, and I was experiencing a rapid succession of bad breaks and misunderstandings, and essentially what was happening is I couldn't run fast enough and they were catching me, and I had sobered up there. It was recommended that I stop drinking, and it had been recommended for quite a period of time that I stop drinking, and I was caught, so I finally began to listen, and I got into an outpatient treatment program and was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in that treatment program. And I'm thankful for that. And so in that respect, I'm thankful for what that program did for me. I don't remember much else from that other than that's where I found AA, or how I found AA. I got a home group eventually. Initially, I did not get into action in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got into a lot of other actions, such as I worked a lot. That, I found, will help you stay sober for a period of time. I had a family, growing family at that time, so I did a lot of those types of actions. So I stayed busy and stayed sober, and I'd go to a meeting whenever I needed to, I guess. Once a week, once a month, whatever seemed to fit the bill. And I thought I was doing sobriety. I really did. And I had some old ideas, and some of those old ideas were that I knew I had a problem with drinking. I did not argue that in the least. But I had some problems with this concept of alcoholism being a disease. You know, I really thought that was kind of a faddy thing, you know, fad of the day type of thing, and that, you know, people use that as a crutch to behave poorly and use it as an excuse for their bad behavior. And you know, I wasn't interested in doing that, I guess, or carrying that flag. That's kind of how I saw it. And I was going to the meetings somewhat, mostly irregularly, I guess that's the best way to describe it. I didn't have a sponsor. Initially, I had a couple of sponsors in name only, and the reason they were in name only is because that's what I insisted on. I did not use them. I didn't stay in touch with them. I did not allow them to help me, and consequently, I continued to get sicker in sobriety. I didn't realize that. For all I knew, that's what sobriety was. And on the outside, if you looked at my life, it looked like it was, you know, I had it all together. I had a great job, had a beautiful wife and a couple of kids, and it looked like things were going well, the job was going well. But inside, you know, that squirrel cage was just continuing to spin, and it was getting a lot faster and a lot louder. And in my business, I stayed very busy from roughly March through November, so I had a lot of things to occupy my mind. But in the winter, things really slowed down, and I had a lot of time to think. And I used to think that was good, time to think. And I'd hear people talking about the committee. I never knew what they were talking about, though. Mine was constantly talking to me, though, and I didn't have a clue what they were talking about. And I just, what was happening is I was just getting a little more miserable all the time, and little more discontented with my life all the time. And eventually, just literally out of pain in here, I started going to more meetings. And I eventually asked someone in a meeting that I heard talk that seemed to make sense or something apparently that I related to. I asked him to help me. I didn't ask him to be my sponsor. I asked him to help me. But he heard, obviously, will you be my sponsor? And he became my first sponsor. And Corky was a great, great example of Alcoholics Anonymous, a very kind and giving man. And he helped me begin to work through the steps and to get a home group and to get active and begin to get active in AA. And active for me at that time was one meeting a week, regularly, though. I was going to one meeting a week. And that was a lot more active than I had been. And I began to work through that book, and it was amazing, the revelations that were starting to happen. And I was just beginning to feel like a sponge in Alcoholics Anonymous and loving what was happening and the awakenings that seemed to be happening. And I found out that AA wasn't just a fad. And I still didn't understand alcoholism, didn't understand Alcoholics Anonymous much. But I was getting lots of information. I was starting to feel a little bit better as I began to work those steps with him. And I was working with Corky for about 2 to 3 years after that, 3.5 years maybe. And I got a job transfer, and it was going to take me to Billings, Montana. I can remember a member of my home group by the name of Paul G. He said a really nasty thing to me. He said, "Well, great. When you move to Billings, you're going to have to get hooked up with that recovery group. They're an active bunch." And it was just like, oh, don't say that word, because it meant I knew what it meant deep inside. It meant that I was going to have to take some action. And he was right. And I'll tell you what, I did one thing right when I moved there. I avoided the recovery group at all costs. And I, in my head, I nodded yes to him. And my sponsor told me, you're going to have to get a new sponsor when you move there. And I nodded yes to him. But inside, I said, there ain't no way. You're the best sponsor in the world. I can't get a new sponsor. Well, I moved to Billings, got real busy with work again. And I presumed didn't have much time to go to meetings. So I was going once a week, once a month, whatever fit my schedule. And I'm not kidding you, in the period of 6 to 8 months, I was nuttier and worse off than I'd ever been drinking. And worse off than I'd been when I first quit drinking that first 2 years. I was just absolutely, I had ideas of a gun barrel stuck in my mouth over and over and over again. And I'm not, at least I don't like to vision myself as a suicidal type of guy. You know, my head wants to tell me I'm more like a Clint Eastwood homicidal type of guy. Come on, baby, make my day, you know. But I just couldn't get that out of my head. And that, you know, my head tells me suicide's weak and bad, and I felt guilty for thinking about that. I'm Catholic too, and geez, that took me for a ride. Had a separate committee session about that going on. Eventually, and I went to a couple of recovery group meetings, and I avoided eye contact. And I was one of these guys who'd come in right before the meeting started, and I'd avoid contact, sit right back by the door, just like we did at the last meeting, so we could get out quick. As soon as the Lord's Prayer was done, I'd duck on out. I didn't want to have to talk to people. At that group, I couldn't avoid them. I've heard it described before as teeth and hands in your face type of thing. And they were, meeting and greeting, and I couldn't avoid them. And I was just desperate enough that I eventually asked a guy, and he's sitting here today, and I want to thank Scott again. I started spilling my guts, blah, 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 about all the things that I knew were wrong with me or and what I felt I needed again, and I didn't ask for a sponsor. I needed to know the truth is what I told him. And, of course, he was a good member of AA. He knew exactly what I needed. And he said, well, you show up, I think he told me, on Tuesday night. You come back here next Tuesday night, which was like the next night or a couple nights, and I want to introduce you to this guy. He can help you, I think. And I nodded my head yes, and inside I said, no, I'm probably never coming back here again. He didn't wave the wand and make me better. But I ended up eventually, like a week later, showing up at that group and saw Scott again. Right away he hustled his sponsor over to me, and we started talking. We went out to coffee after the meeting, and John ended up becoming my sponsor. And John's still my sponsor today, and he asked me to take action. And I was just, today I realized that I was desperate enough, pain, there was enough pain in my life at that time, that I was willing to do what he asked me to do. And he asked me to do some very drastic things. I mean, he asked me, essentially what he asked me to do is get involved in my own sobriety. He asked me to go to 4 meetings a week at least. And I thought, my God, I didn't say this to him, but I thought, I'll lose my job, for God's sake. I'll lose my wife. And now that one was real. I mean, I knew she was not happy with me, and that would probably just add to it. But I have no idea where this thing about the losing the job came from. But in my head, I knew I'd lose my job, and on and on and on. Oh, I just began to take the action he asked me to take. And and my life began to change, and I began to, I understand today what was happening is I began to experience recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've come to find that, you know, I didn't have a clue early on. I thought that just not drinking and coming to some meetings, everything should get wonderful. And I discovered exactly what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about. And that is, over any considerable period of time, if I be a real alcoholic, I'm going to get worse, not better, unless I do something about my alcoholism. And I've come to find out in Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned this in AA. I literally became alcoholic sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, just like you people are today. By God, if I'd have heard somebody say that when I was new, I think I'd have got up and left before it happened or struck me. It's literally what happened. And it happened by listening to people share their experience, strength, and hope. And slowly over a period of time, I began to identify. I began to hear my story in other people, and I realized that I wasn't so unique, so terminally unique like I'd felt for so many years. And Clancy talks about, if there's a magic word in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the word action. And I've come to experience it's absolutely the truth. At least it has been in my life. And the people I watch in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the people ahead of me and the people behind me, and the people that are taking action, regardless of how long I've been sober, if I'm taking action, I've found that my life continues to get better. Doesn't mean that I become immune from the things from life, from what happens, the seemingly good and the seemingly bad, or the difficult times. But I can go through those. I can experience those things without having to drink or medicate. And that's why I used to drink. I used to drink because when I drank, it made whatever the situation was tolerable. It made it, I could live life, it seemed like. And action to, you know, today is not necessarily a nasty word. I don't proclaim to be one to go looking to do cartwheels, looking at where I can be active in Alcoholics Anonymous every day necessarily. My head still talks to me and tells me I got better things to do. But I have learned, and I hope I continue, I hope I remain willing and open-minded enough to continue to be teachable and continue to take those actions regardless of what my head tells me. And I love the results that happen when I do. I was very good at not taking action. I'm a really good guy at just not drinking and go finding the couch, grabbing the channel changer, and doing thumb-ups. I mean, I can do that really well. Thank God for desperation, enough desperation in my life that pushed me into taking action that I had no clue would bring about the results that have literally changed how I feel and how I get to live today. And how I get to feel and live today is I have a way of living, I guess, that literally, as the book says too, solves my problems. And all the things that come up in my life today, I have tools to apply into my life that can allow me to live with, I guess, a sense of peace and ease and comfort and dignity, that I don't have to walk on the shady side of the street or lay in my house and wish that I could just evaporate or get some kind of really drastic disease where people really feel sorry for me. That's what I want. You know, I want people to feel sorry for me and have my picture in the paper when I'm looking good, of course, and wearing a hat like Estelle. I have a way that I used to seek this, what I get to experience in AA. I used to seek that in the bottle. And it really is. I heard people talking about a life beyond my wildest dreams. And it literally is. It's a life beyond my wildest dreams. And it really only continues to get better. And I thank the examples. As Julian shared, when we took that moment of silence for the people, I was taking a moment of silence for the people that have passed this on, have given this thing that I get to enjoy it today. And I really do get to enjoy this. I don't always perceive it that way. That's why one of the reasons I need to keep coming back. And I'm thankful for that. It's good to be here, good to be sober, and I'm thankful for the opportunity. It's an honor and a privilege. I'd like to thank our delegate, Perry, who incidentally is speaking right now in a much smaller room than this. But it's got about three times as many people. Sweet justice, huh? Thank you.
Wayne, thank you very much. And you struck a couple of chords in there with me as you were sharing with us. One of the first things that came to mind was one of my early mentors in AA was a gentleman that during my very first years would continue to remind me that easy does it was not one of the steps. And another thing along that same line was that about the moving experience. During my first years of sobriety, it was necessary for me to relocate on numerous occasions. And that first move, leaving that first sponsor and going to a new town, a new city, and a new sponsor is a traumatic experience for a drunk. At least it was for this one. And what I found out was that the people were just as loving and just as warm, but I had to let them know I was there. They weren't going to roll out the red carpet for me and hug me like the old home group had. But when I walked up to them and stuck out my hand and introduced myself, they were just as warm and as loving as the other one had been once I gave them the chance and made the active effort to introduce myself and to put myself into their program also. Our next speaker will be Bruce.
My name is Bruce Kennedy, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. My home group is the Too Early group in San Francisco, California. And if you ever come to San Francisco and you can get up at 8 o'clock for an 8 o'clock meeting on Saturday morning, it's a terrific meeting. So come join us. Another meeting I like is one that occurs up in the mountains north of San Francisco in a small building that's really dedicated to AA. And they have on the wall up there a sign that has a quotation. It's a quotation from St. Francis of Assisi, and it fits perfectly for AA, I think. The quotation is, "Wherever you go, carry the message, and if necessary, use words." The point being that the main way we carry the message is through action, through the things we do. You can't talk somebody into AA. You can attract them by your life and the way it's worked out for you, but you can't order people to do Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to talk about just one group of AAs who, for me, exemplified this. When I was new in the program, I was about 4 years sober, and I was coming out of a meeting and somebody handed me a flyer. And the flyer was an invitation to go to a place in San Francisco to hear some talk by a group called Creating a Sober World. I thought that was a pretty ambitious view. But what it was that they wanted to tell us about their organization. And they were going to have a teleconferencing of an AA meeting with an AA group in Moscow, Soviet Union. Well, that caught me. I had to go. And I did, and I heard all about this group, and they had been going since 1986, April of 1986. They had been going to the Soviet Union. And they had started 6 or 7 meetings, then 13, 14 meetings. And they did this thing with the teleconferencing. And we sat there and we watched with translators on both ends of the picture. Translators telling them what we were saying on the other end in the hospital. And it was a midnight in Moscow. Telling them what we were saying, and then we had translators telling us what they were saying. And I was just knocked out of my shoes. I thought this was really spectacular. So it took me a couple of years before I could save up enough money and sign up for one of their trips. And by the time I did it, they'd done 14 trips, 13 trips. I went on the 14th. And I got a chance to go to Moscow and to a town, city called Yaroslavl, which is up on the Volga River, and to another city called Moldova at that time. This was all while this was still a Soviet Union. And I couldn't believe what kind of an experience that was. Because I was fairly new in sobriety, but I just sort of went along for the ride, and I sat in one meeting up in Yaroslavl, and they brought a group of alcoholics in. It was in a hospital. They brought a group of alcoholics in, and we sat around a table. And each of us was telling something of our stories and trying to be attractors to AA. And then one young woman who had been very nervous about being there finally said she wanted to say something, Russian lady. And she did, and she told a wonderful story about, and it's one we all know. We've heard it from others. And I sat there, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And as time went on after that time, we went on to, well, as a matter of fact, on that trip, we went on down to Moldova, and we found another group in a hospital. That was the way we worked. We went to hospitals and we talked to doctors first, and then they brought in some of their patients and we would talk to them. But in Moldova, they were so excited, the Russians were. They were Moldovans, I guess now, that they wanted to take us on a picnic. So we thought that's nice. Well, they took us out to the Dniester River, which is not far away, and they had a big boat that would take 30 or 40 people. And we got on that boat, and they took us down the river and to a wonderful park. Now, it wasn't really a formal park. It was just the woods. We went in and had this great picnic. And this is a bunch of brand-new alcoholics getting to know some old-time alcoholics. And then we had Al-Anons with us, too. And again, I had this shiver go up and down my back as this it impressed itself so much upon me of what it must have been like in the early days of AA when some of these guys went out and talked to alcoholics who had never heard of AA, for whom AA was not even a part of their consciousness, and to find a sympathetic and interested ear. I was fortunate enough then to be able to go on more of those trips. I took a lot of money out of my deferred compensation and went to nine trips to Russia. I went all the way from St. Petersburg in the west across some of the cities where Leningrad, Minsk, Sochi, Odessa, Tashkent, Novosibirsk, Khabarovsk, Barnaul, and Magadan. That's 11 time zones. And in between, other people were going too, to other places. Now today in Russia, AA is very powerful. It is very strong. They have their own social service structure. They have their own. They have meetings all over the country. There are a couple of hundred at least meetings, and I haven't kept track recently. But I look back at that and I think, my God, you know, here was a group of people that creating a sober world, who, because of the action they took, and it was not easy to getting that started. There was a woman in Southern California who started it. Really, she had the inspiration, had the idea. And she gathered some other people around her and said, I think we ought to take AA to the Soviet Union. And she inspired them. And they worked for 6 months. And they finally got it organized, and they took a group of about 27, 28 people. And they went over there, and they met with doctors, and they got the first group started, the Moscow Beginners. And as I say, today, it's alive and well in Russia. For me, I had experiences which I think I ought to pass on to you, because it gives you some idea of what the whole idea of alcohol treatment was like in the Soviet Union and in Russia. There's one city that we went to in Siberia where, after we'd been there for a couple of days, the doctors said, well, we have a system for getting people sober, and we'd like to show it to you. And we said, okay. So they took us downtown to an office building about 8 or 10 stories. And they took us in elevator and up several floors. And then in this office area, they said, what we've discovered is that the miners in the salt mines have a lower level of alcoholism than the general population. So we think it has something to do with the salt mines. So they took us into a room. It was about, 10 by 10. And all over the ceiling and all down the walls, they had glued salt. And they had colored lights and music. And they said, want to try it? What we do is we put them in here for 20 minutes at a time for a couple of weeks, and then they're cured. So I said, well, sure. And two or three of us went in, and we sat in lawn chairs. And they closed the door, and these lights, pretty lights, were going on, and the music was playing. And we looked around at the salt, and we stayed in for about 10 minutes. And, you know, I came out sober. But they were experimenting with everything they could think of because they had such a huge problem, and they were trying to find answers to it. Today in Barnaul, there are AA groups. Today in Novosibirsk, there are AA groups. In all those cities that I was privileged to visit, there are living, functioning, strong AA groups. And this message was something that came where it was needed and where it was wanted. They didn't know they wanted it until they heard it, and then they knew they wanted it. Eventually, groups from this organization went on to China. The organization itself only wanted to focus on the Soviet Union, Russia. But some of the people who were in it went on to other places. They went on to China. And you're going to see tomorrow, and Cuba. You're going to see, or tonight, I guess it is, the flags of China and Cuba carried for the first time into the International Convention large meeting. That was the result of the work of a lot of people, but partly because of those AAs who were able to go and carry this message. In China, there was another wonderful story. When we went to one city there, we were in a hospital, and we met with doctors in a big conference room. And they were very polite. They listened to us tell our stories and talk about AA. And we were doing both explaining to the professionals and talking to alcoholics themselves. And when we got we wound down, they said, well, when we come back, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we want to show you what we do about alcoholism. We've learned something very important. So we couldn't hardly wait, and we went out and had a break, came back, and we were sitting around the table. And they brought in a metal table on wheels, and they had a box on it. And I was sitting at one end, and they brought the box around behind me, and I could hear thumping inside the box. Boom, 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 boom. And we could all hear that, and we were trying to figure out what was going to go on. And pretty soon they told us. They said that they had discovered an herbal medicine, a very secret herbal medicine that could cure alcoholism. And they wanted to show it to us. So they pulled out two big white rabbits, huge rabbits, and they lay them down on this metal table, held them there. And these rabbits were trying to get loose and very lively and so forth. And then they brought some alcohol on a bottle and a hose and put it in down their throats and pumped alcohol into the stomachs of these rabbits until they just went limp. And they said, there, now see, that's the way it is to get drunk. And then they pulled that hose out, and then they put another hose in with their secret remedy. And in one of them, not in the other one, they put it in one, and sure enough, shortly after they put it in there, this rabbit perked up, shook his head and his ears, and got back to life while the other one was still lying there trying to sleep it off, I guess. And they were so proud, and they said, well, what do you think of that? And we looked at each other, and I got elected to answer. And I said, well, you know, that was really interesting. What I would say is, if these two rabbits were alcoholics, or if these two rabbits went out drinking together, and they both got drunk in the same bar. And the bar had this magic potion. They could take the magic potion, and then they would both perk up, and they'd be able to go outside in the fresh air. And then one of them being an alcoholic, and the other not being an alcoholic, the non-alcoholic would get in his car and drive home. But the alcoholic would get in his car and drive to another bar. Well, they didn't quite get it. But it was true. Because what they had done was put something into those rabbits, which probably was heavily caffeine, something to wake them up. And it didn't stop them from being drunk at all. It just stopped them from being lying flat and going to sleep. After China, that first trip to China, I was fortunate enough to get an invitation for some of us to come to Cuba. And that was, 12 years ago. A woman in Miami she was an Al-Anon, and she had been wanting to get AA into Cuba for a long time, and she didn't know how to do it. She'd tried to get the Miami Cubans, AAs, to go over there, and they weren't going to go over as long as Castro was there. But she called me in San Francisco, and so we got a group of people together, and we went. It was a roundabout way, and the legality of it was somewhat questionable, but we got there. And a Baptist church in town, in Havana, wanted to get a small group of young alcoholics. They wanted to do something for them. They knew them very well. And so we got them together, and we started talking to them. And these young guys said they wanted to get sober. And so we showed them a way to have meetings, be able to do it after we left, because we were only there for 1 week. And when we left, we didn't know what was going to happen. They formed the group. They gave themselves a name, the Sueño, Grupo Sueño, the Dream Group. They picked the times they were going to meet and all that before we left. And then we left, and then we started hearing things. We heard that the Mexican AAs were going over there. And they'd gotten in touch with the Grupo Sueño, and they were helping them. And they helped them for years. And a couple of years ago, we got an invitation, those of us who'd gone before, to come back for the 10th anniversary of AA in Cuba. And we didn't know what was going to be, but we went, and it was big. You know, this anniversary there were twice as many people there as there are in this room now. They were so excited and so full of energy and so full of life, and they were sober and they were happy to be sober. And they told us that they had 3,000 members in Cuba as a whole and 150 groups. That's in 10 years. And I'll tell you, my mouth dropped. We all were just in awe of what had happened there. The Mexicans deserve a lot of credit for going back and helping and teaching. And it worked. One last thing I want to tell you is that in Havana, when we first went over there, we went to a big hospital, and they showed us around where all the alcoholics were being treated. And after we talked to a few of the alcoholics, they took us back to a room, the doctors did, and they said, one of the doctors told us that, you know, it's interesting what's happened here. He says, we've had all this work trying to get alcoholics to not stop drinking. And he says, you know, what we found is that what really works is if we just leave them alone to talk to each other. And that was what I left Havana with, was that message. Just leave them alone and let them talk to each other. Thanks.
Bruce, thank you very much. Carrying the message is one form of action, very definitely. There's no question about it. I think back into my first 90 days of sobriety, and I was at a club, AA club one afternoon, and a 12-step call came in, and the chief cook and bottle washer came up to me and told me about old George had called in, and he wanted help. He'd been drinking for 45 years, just come off a runner, And he was 65 years old, and he wanted to get sober before he died. And he said that this is his address right here. Now, this man was about 40 years my senior at the time and been drinking all those years. And I thought to myself, oh, you can imagine what ran through my mind. And then Bob said to me, Bill over here doesn't have a car. He's been sober 20 years, and if you can give him a ride, you may be able to carry some help to that gentleman. And it just pointed out to me that there are various ways that we can take action, that we can carry the message, and we don't have to be all that in-depth in the program before we can be of help both to ourselves and to others. Our third speaker this afternoon is Tracy.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tracy. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very honored to be here today and to be of service. And I'm very nervous, and that's a really good thing. I've spoken a lot in the past, and I know that when I'm really, really nervous, usually in a couple seconds, I can let go, and the talk will be okay. When I'm not nervous, that's really bad news for you, because that means I think I know what I'm talking about. So I'm pretty nervous, but I also wanted to thank a bunch of my friends for being here, and you may want to thank them too, because I think they'll be keeping me humble and keeping me honest today. First, I want to just let you briefly know a little bit about me. I am what may be referred to as a high bottom drunk. What I knew about alcohol at an early age is that it would take away physical pain. And around the age of 13, that translated into taking away emotional pain. And that's what I sought relief for many years in that way. I had the problems that I had were not DUIs, et cetera, et cetera. The problems that I had were jealous men because I wasn't faithful. And I also had problems where I visited a lot of hospitals, et cetera, et cetera. I think now that was maybe alcohol poisoning, I don't know. Dehydration, stuff like that. So those were my problems. And when I got to, when I was in college, I had a nurse tell me that I needed to stop drinking or I would die when I was in the emergency room. And my thought was, she's in the wrong room. but that stuck in the back of my mind, and I began to try to control my drinking from that point. And I tried a lot of methods that all of you used, self-help, change the men. I date a man who didn't drink, and he's here tonight. In fact, today is our 16th wedding anniversary. I tried religion. I just tried a lot of things. Nothing worked. Basically, when I hit my bottom, I was completely, everything was about me. The entire world was about me. How everybody hated me, how ugly I was, how much I hated myself. How much I hated my family, how much I hated my job, how much bad luck I'd had, how the economy was so bad to me, et cetera, et cetera. And that's where I was when I hit my bottom. And I was out of answers. I was out of solutions at that time, and had just hit my knees. And I'd been trying to control it for a while, and I had just picked up a drink. And at that moment, I realized that everything that I had done to control my drinking didn't work, and I didn't have any ideas how not to drink anymore. And my husband was sober about 7 years at that time, so I'd been in Al-Anon, whatnot. And so I came in the back door, but I still didn't really know I was an alcoholic. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I thought you had to drink wine in the park. You had to ride on the luggage rack of cars. That's what my husband did, so that's what alcoholics did. I didn't think, I didn't think it had anything to do with not knowing who you were going to go home with or something like that. So, anyways, but when I got sober, I was reluctant. I was a bit like Wayne was talking about. I was not into service. I was not into helping people. In fact, I did about the same number of meetings as Wayne. I'd asked somebody, how many meetings do you go to in a week? And they said, well, how often did you drink? And, I forgot about, before I started to control my drinking. And all I thought about was, there were times that I'd gone a month or two or something like that without a drink. So I thought going to one meeting a week was overkill. And that's how I worked my program for a while. And I was miserable. And, in fact, it was a long, I was so afraid of people at that time that when I went to a meeting is when I wanted to drink. Being in the meeting with the room of all of you is when the craving came upon me because I was so afraid of you. But I also knew at the same time that if I didn't go to the meeting, I wasn't going to stay sober. So somehow that won out for me. That bottom was September 3rd, 1990, and by the grace of God and good sponsorship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink since that day. For that, I'm very grateful to all of you and for all of you being here at the convention and helping us to stay sober one more day. So let's see. So I told you about how I was. In fact, nobody asked me to sponsor them until I was about 3.5 years sober. So, and I'll tell you what, God really took care of that woman. She got what she needed from me, and then God moved me away so she could have somebody else to help her. And she's here today. That woman is here today. And I'm so glad. So our topic, when I got the topic, I was really scared. I was like, what the heck is this topic about? And I had just gone to our regional convention, our regional service assembly. And at that convention, somebody said, I didn't look when I started here. Okay. But at the convention, somebody said, there was a big room, I don't know, like 500 people or whatever. They said, raise your hand if you've read your service manual cover to cover. And a lot of people raised their hands. And I did not. I've referenced it, right? but I've read little things here and there when people point them out to me, but I didn't read it cover to cover. So I went back to my room that night, and I started here reading. And I read that Declaration of Unity, Responsibility, Kaibel Contents, pass up. And here on this first page here, S1, I'm going to read you three sentences here. S1 says, this is AA's Legacy of Service by Bill W., our 12th step, carrying the message, is a basic service that the AA Fellowship gives. This is our principal aim and the main reason for our existence. Therefore, AA is much more than a set of principles. It is a society of alcoholics in action. We must carry the message, else we ourselves can wither, and those who haven't been given the truth may die. I didn't get serious in the steps till I was about 7 years sober. And then my life began to change. But you know what? The only thing I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous in sobriety was recovery. I didn't know about our three legacies, recovery, unity, and service. I didn't know about the 36 principles. I'd heard of the steps, of course. So I'm doing them. I heard of the traditions. Every once in a while, I went to a tradition meeting. But I'd never heard of the 12 concepts. So that's about where I was. I started a new meeting, and it occurred to me that I'd done a lot of service work by that time, secretary this, da, 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 da. And I thought, well, I'm about 9 years sober or whatever. It might be time to go be a GSR, a general service representative. I said, in my mind, I thought that's the drudgery job. It's, it's so boring, but I guess I should pay my dues. And so I went off to be the GSR. And what I was thinking about service is that, I'm doing the service to help someone else. I'm doing the service because I know that, when I'm doing it, I get to feel useful. I get to feel good. The thing I was always seeking before, from the bottle. But the thing that's happened is that by doing service, I've been transformed. And we all know this, you know, like from the first time you're the coffee maker, whatever, you know, because you got to go to the meeting, right? I didn't know it was going to happen, you know, in general service. I didn't know it was going to happen. I put down a couple examples here that I wanted to talk about. Oh, and I forgot here. The other thing that occurred to me was, well, my delegate suggested I look up a couple words. I don't know where she was here earlier. I don't know where she went. But anyway, so I looked up society. It was very interesting to me. It said a society is a group of people, a group of alcoholics, that have a common way of life. And I started thinking about, you know, what we all have in common. A lot of alcoholics out there, right? But we in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have something in common, our 36 principles, and how we stay sober and helping other people. I just wanted to share with you some of the ways that God transformed me in general service. When I was thinking about the third legacy, I'm sorry I'm jumping around a little bit, but, you know, I mean, there are whole parts to it, right? How we help at their meeting, our home group, how we sponsor, all these parts to it. So I've been sponsoring for quite a while, and I wouldn't be sober today without my sponsor and the women that I do sponsor. I mean, they saved my life. They saved my marriage. You know, every time I run up the stairs to yell at my husband, the phone rings and some sponsee has got to talk to me about who they were yelling at. You know, it gives me a little breather, and my husband usually doesn't get yelled at because it gives me enough time to think about calling my sponsor. I recently moved. I am was from my home group was the Living by the Book group in Epping, New Hampshire, but moved 2 weeks ago, and I don't quite have a home group yet, but I think it's going to be the Way Out group in Mecklenburg, New York. Anyways, one of my sponsees called me on that day that group was supposed to meet, and I had no intention of going to that meeting. She said, "You know, you're going to that great meeting you told me about," and I was like, "Yeah." Yeah, I'm going. And so I went. So, you know, I mean, I can't say enough about sponsorship, but for some reason I felt led to tell a little bit about general service today. So one of the examples I wanted to talk about was one of the things I learned in being a GSR. Well, I have this character defect. I don't know if you have the same one here. This particular one about I always have to say my opinion. And I always think my opinion is very important. And usually my ideas are way better than yours. And that you must hear them. And had quite an effect in being in my district. Let's see. So basically, one of the examples that happened was one night. I'm sorry, I'm so nervous. Okay, so somebody very gently asked me if I'd ever heard of Robert's Rules, and I hadn't. But basically, eventually, I got around to looking them up, and I noticed that they're in our handbook for the area, which I'd never read either. And it had a couple suggestions on it. One of the suggestions was that whenever a topic came up, that you only speak on it once. And I looked back at my behavior over the last 2 years and being GSR and realized, you know, every topic I had, I spoke 3, 4, 5, maybe more times. And these people in my district were so patient to listen to me each time. I couldn't believe it. What I had learned from that over time is two things. One, there's the concept one that reads something like the final responsibility and ultimate authority resides in the collective consciousness of our group. I should have written it out exactly. But the thing that I was learning about from that is that, you know, God's running the show, not me. I found over trying to practice only saying my opinion one time and then later just trying not to say it because I'm not so important, that, you know what, whenever there was a good idea, somebody said it. I didn't have to do it. God was there. And over time, in working with my district, I also learned that when I came with what I thought was a good idea, and just bring it and let it go, that God transformed it. God transformed it into something better. And what I learned about was the power of the group. When people show up and they're working their program of Alcoholics Anonymous, how much better we can be and how many more people that we can help. And this translated into my marriage. You know, I did it because I thought it was my duty. You know, I didn't do it because I thought it was going to help my marriage. And, you know, when I started doing general service, my marriage was really bad. We were hating each other and yelling at each other, and it was really bad. And what I got from this piece of general service was I began to learn how to listen to my husband. And I started to get to know him and who he was. And I've been married to him for like 10 years. By that time, I didn't even know who he was. So I hadn't expected that. How much more time do I have? I'm really clueless. Oh, okay. All right. A few minutes, you said? Five. Okay. One of the other character defects I had is that I like to run from controversy. Anytime that the conversation, the topic, whatever, gets difficult, I like to run. I'm not going to go through the whole example, but basically our district, you know, they were trying to talk about the prudent reserve, and I decided to make a motion to get it over with so we could vote on it, right? So I made this motion. I didn't write it down. I didn't think about what I was going to say, because, of course, I thought the opinion thing, I had the right idea, whatever. The result was our meeting starts at 7, and we were there till 9:45 because I made a bad motion. I hadn't prayed and whatever. You know, I was just thinking that I knew how to fix everything. From that, I began to learn a little bit about unity. And from my sponsor and showing up and making amends, I've been learning, what's happened is I've been learning how to translate that into my marriage. My husband and I can now talk about money. I can't tell you how many years we could not talk about money. We could not have a conversation about money. And now we can have conversations about money because I can learn how to stay put when we're talking about it. I don't have to have a temper tantrum. I don't have to run away. When I hear something scary, I can just stay put, keep my mouth shut if I need to, and just listen and maybe ask some questions. And that's, you know, taught to me from Alcoholics Anonymous. The last example I wanted to give is one of my other character defects is that I spent most of my life blaming everybody I could for my unhappiness. in any way I could, I tried to get you to make decisions for me, et cetera, et cetera. I ended up becoming DCM in my district. Because basically there's nobody else wanted to do it, you know, but there's some responsibility goes with that, you know. We talk about our services, our levels of responsibility, and I had to learn how to be a leader. And somebody actually pointed out in the service manual back when it talks about in the back about concept 9, back there's an actual article by Bill W. on leadership, and I began to learn about leadership, and basically that if we have skills and talents, it's our responsibility to step up to the plate. We talked earlier meeting was talking about leading by example, you know, not by telling everybody what to do. Is that I had to lead by example, and that means when I screw up, I got to make amends too. And at my very the second to last district meeting, I was telling everybody I'm moving away, right? At that very same meeting, I did something really bad that I had to make amends for. And basically what I did was I interfered with the election process. Somebody was being elected for a position, and I whispered to him about some other position and encouraged him to sit down. So I had to go back to my next meeting, and I had to make amends for that, you know. There was something I wanted to say about that. It's just escaped me. Anyways, that was really wrong. And to make amends for it. I guess what I was talking about, leading by example. Oh, I know. Because the whole time everybody was saying, you know, how sad they were I was leaving, all this other stuff. But God was helping me with my humility because I had just you know, I couldn't be sitting there being perfect because I had really done this, I'd caused a lot of harm that I need to make amends for. So God has helped me walk through all of this. And, you know, the result of talking about this particular concept is I wanted to just say that what it has brought to me and my friendships and my family is that I have been learning how to bring peace to a relationship instead of the chaos that I brought before. Because basically, I didn't make amends before. I didn't do 10 steps before. I didn't acknowledge harm that I caused other people. You know, if somebody asked where we wanted to go to dinner, I could never tell them where I wanted to go. But when they went where I didn't want to go, I whined and complained the whole time, you know. Basically, learning how to be a leader, I got to step up and say where I want to go. And then if we go somewhere else, then, you know, I got to be, you know, gracious about it. You know, because, you know, when we're a leader in Alcoholics Anonymous, people are watching us. Our sponsees are watching us. The other GSRs are watching us. And that's been really good for me because, and I learned that even at the district meeting, you know, at the regular meetings, people are watching. And I don't know why God chose to help me in that manner, but it was exactly what I needed. Because when I think people are not watching me, I'm not very good with my behavior. And all this, I just want to say, this transformation occurred in my life God has transformed me, and all I did was show up and follow directions to the best of my ability, and I made lots of mistakes. That's what I want to share with you, were the mistakes, and it was all because I was trying to help others and be useful. It wasn't because I went to do it so that I could have a good marriage. I didn't go to do it so that I could, you know, be friends with my mother. I didn't go to do it for any of those things. I did it to help another alcoholic, and that's the irony, I guess, of this program. So thank you very much. I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for giving me this life and everything. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you very much.